Person speaking will be John Haynes. He is a graduate of the University of South Alabama, and he has a BS in meteorology, and he has an MS. He graduated in 2002 from the University of Oklahoma, and he entered the federal workforce at NASA in 2002 through the Presidential Management Fellowship Program. He is now the program manager for public health at NASA, as well as the manager for weather applications, air quality, and the Gulf of Mexico initiative in the applied sciences area. John.
Thank you, Sue, and thank you for being here with us this afternoon. Hoping to give you a little kind of thumbnail sketch of what NASA's Public Health Applications Program is about, and more broadly the Earth Science Program, and how it applies beyond just basic climate research to areas like public health applications for agencies like DOD, CDC, EPA, and others. Nothing to disclose. For NASA, it always starts here with the 2010 NASA Science Plan. This defines our mission in NASA Earth Science as to advance Earth system science to meet the challenges of climate and environmental change. And this is not a new mission for NASA. Most people, when they think of NASA, of course, think about our planetary or human exploration successes, such as the Apollo program, shuttle, space station, and our trips throughout the solar system. But from the very beginning, when NASA was founded in 1958, in the Space Act of 1958, one of the key missions of NASA was Earth science, to advance the knowledge of the Earth system and to spread that knowledge worldwide through scientific collaboration. And that began in 1960 with the launch of the first NASA weather satellite called TIRAS-1. And so over the past 50 years, we've certainly built and expanded on this program to where today NASA is the largest Earth remote sensing observation agency in the world with a budget of about $1.3 billion annually. So these are the six focus areas of Earth system science, including weather, Earth surface and interior, climate variability and change, carbon cycle and ecosystems, atmospheric composition, and the water and energy cycle. We also work very closely with our colleagues in NASA heliophysics to study the Sun-Earth connection and how solar variability affects the climate of Earth. Climate variability and change, I'm just going to point out to say that in the U.S. Global Climate Change Research Program, which is the federal consortium that coordinates all of our agency's efforts in climate change, NASA is the largest contributing member to that organization. And you can certainly see where many of these focus areas have an impact on public health on the planet. And for us at NASA, all the work begins hundreds of miles above our head in space with our constellation of now 16 Earth-observing satellites, including the USGS-operated Landsat 7. These 16 satellites, and you may be counting, there's 15 up here, but we just launched a new satellite on October 28th, a few days ago. Our newest satellite, the IMPOSE Preparatory Project, was launched successfully last Friday morning, and I'll talk a little bit more about it in a second, but I didn't put it on this slide before I uploaded. Didn't want to jinx a launch by putting it up here. But these 16 satellites actually are downloading every day literally terabytes of data to the ground on all different types of Earth parameters, Earth observations about the climate and weather that's going on our planet and how it is dynamically changing. And so these are just some of the basic science questions and observations we've been able to make over the past 15 years from these satellites. For example, the TRIM satellite, that stands for the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission. It's a satellite that actually is able to peer through the clouds and actually get a radar-like image, both in the horizontal and vertical of cloud structures across the planet. And it's in cooperation with our partners at the Japanese Space Agency. What you're seeing here is a cross-section of Hurricane Katrina, when it had emerged into the Gulf of Mexico, heading for New Orleans. But this was right before its very rapid intensification took place. It was about a Category 2 storm at this point. But you look here on the cross-section, you see that TRIM's precipitation radar is actually seeing these very deep eyewall towers firing right near the center of the hurricane, up to 16 kilometers high in cloud tops. This heralded the rapid intensification that was about to take place in the hurricane. And this observation has been seen in hurricanes and typhoons by TRIM worldwide. It was one of the major discoveries of this mission, helping us better anticipate and forecast when hurricanes and typhoons are about to undergo a rapid intensification cycle. This is an image of sea surface height. This is actually taken from the OSTM mission, stands for Ocean Surface Topography Mission, which is in cooperation with our partners at the French Space Agency and at NOAA. And so it's actually looking at changes from the baseline zero in sea surface height across the planet. very important, of course, for climate change observations, but in terms of forecasting seasonal variability of weather patterns on the planet, it's very useful for looking for El Niño and La Niña. What you're seeing here is, as El Niño was beginning to form in the eastern Pacific off the coast of South America, as the waters were warming, as a column of water warms, it actually expands. So the sea surface height increases. So you're seeing there in the red the anomaly in sea surface height heralding the beginning of El Niño that was going to continue to develop throughout the winter of 09 and 10, causing major changes in worldwide weather patterns. For those of you who are here on the East Coast, you may have remembered that winter as the ones of Snowpocalypse, Snowmageddon, and Snowverkill, which is what we called our three blizzards that year. Not doesn't happen quite often, and this was one of the factors responsible. This is an image from MODIS, and you'll hear me discuss MODIS a good bit because MODIS is on two of our satellites, on Terra and Aqua. And MODIS is really a workhorse in Earth system science. It looks at over 20 different spectral wavelengths. So you're looking at everything from visible to infrared to ultraviolet to ocean color. You basically almost name the observation, and MODIS can be able to take it and give you information. This is a visible image of MODIS in 2004 in July. And if you were just to take a look at this image, much like you would see on the nightly weather forecast on TV, you would think that maybe these were low clouds or fog, possibly over the central United States. But if we go over to the aerosol optical depth measurement of MODIS, we'll actually see that this is smoke from Alaska and Yukon wildfires that was being ejected by the jet stream into the central United States. And you see there on the other side the PM2.5 aerosol loading that was occurring in this area. And this is, of course, a very important measurement for many different types of air quality and public health projects. So in the Applied Sciences program itself, as part of Earth science in general at NASA, we strive to advance the realization of societal and economic benefits from NASA Earth science by identifying the societal needs, conducting applied research and development, and collaborating with application developers and end users. So you can think of us kind of as a bridge between the results of basic NASA science, Earth science research, be it technology, mission development, the operations, the archiving of the data, the model predictive capabilities, and of what the societal needs of end user agencies and groups are. They need to know better, have improved data for management decisions, policy decisions, forecasting, and emergency preparedness and response. Back in the late 90s, the National Academies actually did a study lamenting the state of the transfer of information from research to operations in the federal government. They actually called it the Valley of Death, where good science went to die before it could be used for the general public good. So the NASA Applied Sciences Program was actually formed in 2000 to help be this bridge over the Valley of Death. And we do our work in eight focus areas, one of which is included is public health and the air quality area, which we're actually now joining those portfolios together into one, the health and air quality portfolio. So why public health? Again, as you noticed, I was saying so much about the weather research, the climate change research, and that's what NASA's primary mission is. But because of the research we do on that, we can also now apply those lessons to the potential health effects of climate variability and change, both naturally occurring and anthropogenically induced. And because those climate changes impact regional weather, heat waves, extreme weather, temperature and precipitation changes across the planet. Also air pollution levels and the way that air pollution is evicted across the planet. And you can see on the other side all the potential health effects of these changes, including water and foodborne diseases, vector and rodent-borne diseases, and heat-related illnesses and deaths. There's also the issue of global emerging diseases. This is an image taken from Nature magazine of all the emerging diseases over the past couple decades in the world. Now, at NASA, we can have a part to play in better characterization and mitigation of infectious disease risk if the vector is affected by an environmental parameter we can remotely sense from space. So things like HIV, obviously, we don't have a part to play in. But other diseases like Rift Valley fever, dengue fever, malaria being carried by mosquitoes, certainly the environment impacts their habitats and where the vectors are located. And there's always, unfortunately, new environmental threats that are emerging. This is a visible image, again from MODIS, of the Deepwater Horizon oil slick off the central Gulf of Mexico in May of last year. One of the things we learned from our NASA satellites, particularly Calypso, which is actually an aerosol LIDAR that is on orbit. Basically, a LIDAR is like a radar system, but using lasers. Calypso was able to actually see that these volatile organic compounds were degassing off the oil slick. And when they were reacting with nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere, it was producing ozone. And the ozone was then being infected by the sea breezes on shore, causing respiratory distress for a lot of individuals across the Mississippi and Louisiana Gulf coasts. So in the public health area, we focus on infectious disease, like you've heard me mention, emergency preparedness and response, and environmental health issues. And I'm just going to give a couple of examples of some of the projects in our portfolio. We currently are funding over 25 projects in the public health program with partners both domestically in the states and the federal government, as well as with international partners. One of the ones is a collaboration with the CDC and the EPA to enhance the Environmental Public Health Tracking Network. The Environmental Public Health Tracking Network, or EPHTN, was put into operational use by the CDC in 2009 to help better link the states and the federal government in the transfer of data on chronic diseases and also on environmental data that impacts those diseases. We've been working with the CDC, and that's supposed to be in motion, but it was going to be a neat animation, but, you know, didn't transfer over. We've been working with the CDC to get better, more accurate representations of PM2.5 levels across the metro Atlanta area. The pink triangles are the EPA air quality system ground data points. But we've been combining that information through a series of algorithms with information from aerosol optical depth from MODIS, which if this was in motion, you could see how it would change over time, to combine those two measurements to get a more representative view of what truly is the air pollution levels with PM2.5 over metro Atlanta, which is linked, of course, to cardiovascular distress among many individuals. We've also worked with such partners as Kaiser Permanente to start linking this information to their database of respiratory distress admissions in metro Atlanta clinics during bad air quality days. We are continuing this project and actually expanding it with Yang Liu at Emory University to include the suburban 20-county area around metro Atlanta and include more ground data, including traffic counts from traffic cameras and socioeconomic data from the census to help even get more precise information about what the levels of air pollution are, not only in the immediate metro, but in the suburban and rural areas as well. Dust is a big concern, PM10, in the desert southwest. And we have been working very closely with the CDC because New Mexico is an Environmental Public Health Tracking Network state. And the University of New Mexico and the University of Arizona, as well as the State Health Department in New Mexico, to get better forecasts of dust storms across the southwestern United States. What you're seeing here is a dust storm taken from a visible NOAA GOES image in 2003 across West Texas. Using a model that was developed called DREAM for Dust Regional Atmospheric Model, which is actually nested inside a NOAA numerical weather prediction model, we were able to take that model, run it without using MODIS land cover observations, and you see on the lower left the model output of this dust storm. After MODIS land cover observations are assimilated into the model, you see it's a much better representation of the actual dust storm occurring. At this point, we're to the point now where we're able to forecast with 48 hours notice about two-thirds of the dust storms that affect the desert southwest now, thanks to the assimilation of NASA data. And this information is posted in a real-time basis on the portal, web portal for the state of New Mexico's health department for use by end users across the state, and it's also linked to the CDC. Malaria, as I mentioned, is a terrible economic and human death toll burden in much of the world, killing up to 3 million people annually. We've worked very closely with such agencies such as the USAID, DOD, and USGS to use NASA data such as precipitation data from TRIM, which I mentioned earlier, MODIS data, including one of MODIS's observations of vegetation density or greenness, also using other observations of land surface temperature from MODIS, to assimilate into models that are used by DOD, USAID, and USGS to better characterize the risk of malaria to, for example, humanitarian personnel in sub-Saharan Africa for USAID, or for our military personnel in Southeast Asia and in Afghanistan. Currently, in fact, you can see rolling 10-day rainfall anomaly products and 8-day vectoral capacity, how many mosquitoes that may carry malaria are in an area, are being produced and posted on the FuseNet Africa data portal by the USGS that are coming from this NASA data. We tend to run a new solicitation about once every 1 to 2 years to refresh our portfolio and get more projects and new ideas included and funded. And it's a competitive selection process through the NASA Omnibus Science Solicitation. Our last run at this was in selections were made in January 2011. We selected 9 new public health applications projects during that solicitation, which represented an investment of $1.3 million over the next 2 years. These are just the 5 that I put here on note just to show our international breadth, since I was talking a good bit about domestic. But these are 5 new projects from that solicitation that have an international focus. So as you can see, our list of partners is very wide and broad, all the way from government public health agencies and remote sensing agencies to NGOs, certainly many academic institutions, as well as our international partners. Just to give you an idea of what's coming up in the future, what are the new satellites that we're launching? Because satellites don't last forever. And luckily, many of ours have lasted much longer than their supposed nominal lifetime of usually about 5 years. For example, TRIM was launched in 1997 and is still going strong. But these are the ones that we're launching in the near future that have applications for help. NPP, which I mentioned a moment ago, launched on October 28th. It serves as a bridge mission between Terra, Aura, and Aqua, our flagship sensors that include MODIS, and the Operational Joint Polar Satellite System that will be a NOAA constellation that will begin to be launched in 2016. So INPOS carries on board of it the next generation, if you will, of MODIS, and the next generation of several other sensors. So in case we lose those over the next few years, there will be this bridge while the JPSS constellation is being developed and launched. Working with USGS, we're going to launch in 2012 the Landsat Data Continuity Mission. Landsat has been in orbit, many different Landsats have been in orbit starting since 1973. This will continue its land use, land cover observations into this decade and through this decade. The Global Precipitation Mission, in cooperation with JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, will launch in 2014, continuing the heritage of TRIM and those precipitation radar types of data that we are currently getting. HISPERI will launch approximately in 2020. It will employ a hyperspectral imager that will only be our second hyperspectral imager that will have been put on orbit, as well as a thermal infrared scanner to monitor a wide variety of ecological and geological features of the planet, including vegetation type and deforestation issues. Certainly have a public health impact there. And the Soil Moisture Active Passive Mission in 2014 will launch, and getting us information on freeze-thaw state and soil moisture is going to be a huge boon for the numerical weather prediction models. It's one of our least accurate observations that we have to input into models to better predict weather and short-term climate. So getting this type of information into the models will certainly improve those, which improves a lot of our malaria risk characterization models that come from those or environmental health type of decision support tools. So in 2011, these were our 2 new satellites in red that launched this year. Aquarius, I didn't mention, it's a sea surface salinity mission, so limited applications to public health, but certainly NPP. 2012, this is what the constellation will look like. God and funding willing, I guess I should say, with LDCM added. And in 2013, again, that's what the constellation will look like. Another satellite will be launched at that point. OCO2 is the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, taking a look at carbon loading in the atmosphere for climate change research. So if you'd like more information, I would encourage you to go to appliedsciences.nasa.gov and also our website at Marshall Space Flight Center, where you'll actually be able to see all presentations on all 25 or so of our current projects that we have in our portfolio. And just going to end here just to show how far the science has come as far as using Earth observations for epidemiology. In the upper left-hand corner there is John Snow's mid-1850s hand-drawn maps when he first linked cholera to the water pump on Broad Street in London. Then over on the upper right is aerial photography of that same neighborhood in London. And that aerial photography revolution to be used in epidemiological studies started in the 1930s, 1940s. Then we go to the lower left, where GIS and the computer revolution came in starting in the 1970s to be able to add that power to epidemiological studies. And then finally in the lower right, that's a Landsat land cover land use image of southeastern England taken from hundreds of miles above our heads in space. So over the course of 150 years, we've gone from drawing hand-drawn maps with pencils and pens to actually observing the Earth and how it changes from hundreds of miles above us in orbit. And NASA, working with all of our partners, both domestic and international, hopes to continue to advance the epidemiological science into the 21st century. Thanks so much.